And we're getting down to the end now. I mean, we're in the last few chapters. We're going to try to cover two or three tonight. Then next week, two or three more, and we're going to be done with Genesis. So we've been doing Genesis from January, the beginning of January to the end of December, 1 year study. And we have learned a ton this year. It's been amazing. But this section that we're in is the move of the rest of the Israelites into Egypt. And there's a bunch of things about this we need to look at. Before I get to that, I wanted to give you three side note updates really fast. We've mentioned some of these things before, but just so you have those things on your radar in case there's something you want to do or be involved with in some way, or if someone you know or come upon over the next few months or weeks or whatever happens to be like that. So, first of all, there's Patmos. This looks like September. We'll be talking about this. January, February, we'll probably be locking everybody in March and going in September. What this is a sort of an advanced, exciting, adult learning Bible study of Revelation on the Isle of Patmos where it was written down. So we're going to meet in Athens. We're going to take the journey over by ferry. And once we get this nailed down with my particular team in Greece and with all that working for us, then we're going to, after we do this a couple times, we'll probably do Corinthians in Corinth. And then who knows what else we'll do after that. But this will be Bible study that we'll do. And we'll try to keep those things around a week-ish and around $3,000-ish. So it's not for everybody. People have to have like a week off of work and $3,000 extra laying around. That's not for everybody. But we don't need, you know, more than 5 or 10 people to go anyway to make it work. So if anybody wants to do that or knows anybody that might like something like that, they'll be announcing that it'll be in the church-wide in some of the announcements in January and February. So that's Patmos. Philippines. Looks like I'm going to be there in January prior to this kickoff of Break Free. Working with the university there, the University of St. Paul's is a 6-campus private university, and we're going to be working on developing turning their hospitality program into an elite hospitality program that can give them access to the whole world. And while we're there, of course, I'm spending the entire time with the nuns and the leaders, and the idea is to spread the knowledge of and hopefully God will make a move with the Holy Spirit there, because everybody is not, Holy Spirit's not their thing, okay? So we'll see. We'll see what happens. God will do what he'll do. And then East Africa. Kenya and Uganda. For 8 or 9 years, I've been working with a guy who's a minister on the ground there. He does discipleship training, and he's been trying to figure out a way to get a culinary school together because there's a lot of resorts and 5-star hotels and restaurants for tourists. You know, this is where you go if you want to go, you know, do one of those photography safaris of elephants and giraffes and all that. And the people that are local are kind of underprivileged, so the idea is to train them in hospitality, hotel, restaurant arts, let them, you know, get better jobs and improve their livelihood and their family and everything. But now he has 4 acres of land, so he's going to come look at and see if we can build a culinary school for all of East Africa on the border of Kenya and Uganda. I've already got several people that may be in a position to run that thing if we get it going. So that's what we'll be doing probably also in September. So there'll probably be a Greek trip and an African trip, both in September. So don't come looking for any special coffee. It'll be Karen back there going, well, see, we've got this drip coffee that's delicious.
Yeah.
But anyway, we'll see what happens. Hopefully there'll be somebody else trained for on coffee by then.
We'll have somebody else.
But anyway, so that's sort of the side notes to keep on your radar in case anything comes along. If you start hearing about something or somebody says, man, I wish I had a place to go work in Africa or whatever, I don't know, whatever, random. Because God does crazy random stuff. you never know. You'll have this friend who'll say something weird, and all of a sudden they'll be somewhere else. I just ran into a guy that happened to a few years back today. He ended up in Tijuana. I took him down there to work with me on a crew at a base down there to do an opening ceremony for the new kitchen, and he just stayed. And now he's back at UCCS finishing his degree in Spanish because he's fluent now, and in Spanish cuisine and language. So anyway, that's side notes. So on the subject of why this is so important when it comes to the overview of the Bible, archaeology, history, etc. This movement here into Egypt is key. So we're going to end Genesis by all the Israelites moving into Egypt. And God's going to let them go, and they're going to be guided there, and everything's going to make a whole lot of sense. And he's going to tell them it's okay, everything's going to be all right. And then we know they're going to spend a very long period of time there. How much time they spend is under debate. Now the Bible says 400 years one time and 430 years one time. That's not a contradiction. 400 years is the time in slavery, 430 is the total time. So what we're supposed to draw from that by putting the pieces of the puzzle together is that they get there and they're not in slavery, which we know. Joseph is in charge. And somewhere later, approximately 30 years, they end up in slavery. So something like 30 years. The total time being 430. Now where is that time based from? That time is based from the Exodus. How do we get the Exodus timeline? See, this is it. If you can't connect these dots, and this is what the trouble has been for 1,000 years, because the scholars were not able to connect the dots. It's very difficult. And you'll have this thing like the Kohath problem, which we're going to talk about in a minute, or all this other stuff will happen. But this is what the scripture says. 1 Kings 6:1. In the 480th year, after the children of Israel were come out of the land of Egypt, in the fourth year of Solomon's reign over Israel, in the month of Ziph, which is the second month, that he began to build the house of the Lord. Now, that is really specific. The Bible is not going to do that unless we need to know that, and it's that specific. We don't only get the fourth year of Solomon's reign, we get a month, and we get the 480th year after the children of Israel came out of the land of Egypt. This is our key passage to doing this timeline. We can either believe that or not believe that. Okay, I would recommend believing it. So, otherwise, we're going to have trouble with class. If we don't believe the Bible, we're going to run into trouble very, very quick. But that gives us, how do we get the Solomon dates? And so this is why we had the archaeology seminar, trying to nail down Solomon dates, right? Because the archaeologists are arguing like tooth and nail about David and Solomon. There's a camp that believes David and Solomon never existed. That the whole thing of Israel was maybe some random tribes doing some random stuff in some towns, and it was never a big deal. Those scientists cannot explain, like Jerusalem, the way it is with, you know, giant structures. But the problem is, you can't excavate Jerusalem. You can't go to Temple Mount and start digging holes. Now, if you did, you're going to find the original Temple of Solomon. You're going to have evidence of Solomon and David. Everything's going to be super easy. But you can't do that because you got three major religious factions, lots of political unrest, lots of people getting harmed on a daily basis. It's a very scary proposition, and they're just not going to give you permits to start digging holes around Jerusalem. So that's making it difficult to do any kind of proof, okay, of what we're talking about. But other archaeologists have become very, very good at this and have done digs on the edges of stuff, or digs over here in this town that was related to this town, and they found a whole lot of stuff. Things like evidence of, stamps or impressions or seals. They found references to the House of David on Stele. We talked about that during the seminar. So we've got a pretty good idea that we're dealing with around the year 966 give or take a year. Everything I say, give or take a year here and there, at least a year, because no matter how specific the science is, it can never be absolutely 100% exact, because there's just too many variables. There's a shifting in the way that we keep time. There's shifting in the way that there is we have calendars. But most importantly, when you date something, there's always a scientific plus or minus. Now, I'm not talking about a single type of dating. If we try to use a single type of dating, something like carbon-14 dating, there's a problem, because carbon-14 dating is based on the degradation of a radioactive isotope. Okay, I'm not trying to sound crazy, but what it means is there's a radioactive material that is decaying, and that rate of decay is steady and set. And it says half-life is a certain number of years. It's 5,000-ish years, right? You can track exactly how long this living thing's been dead by how much of that stuff has decayed. So right now, as we walk around the sun and sit here, we're absorbing a load of carbon-14. When we die, we stop absorbing and start decaying the carbon-14. And then 2,000 years from now, when they dig that bone up or that hair follicle or whatever it is, and they test it, they can get a relatively accurate date based on the amount of a carbon-14 that's remaining. However, because it's radioactive, if anything radioactive happens near it or around it, like let's say we all died right here and this was a site that was being dug up and the ground is 20 feet above us, and 5,000 years from now they're digging us up. But right before that, a truck carrying radioactive waste, you know, to hide in past divide somewhere in a cave, comes driving by us, it would mess those readings up. You understand? Or if there's a big solar flare. So the scientists have been trying to track all of that, all that radiation difference, and they've been using cross-referencing with things like pottery, things like written accounts, things like dendrochronology, which is tree rings. They've been cross-referencing. Tree rings are very important because the rings of a tree, as we all know, they come onto a tree and they're like clockwork. You got a ring every year. And these rings are thicker in a really good season and thinner in a dry season and have burn scars in a burn. And you can track these years. Well, just imagine if in this tree right here, there was a fat year here, and then a thin year, and then two fat years, and a burn scar, and then two fat years. And that pattern appeared on a tree over here, way out near the edge, and now we track that in. And then we cross-reference. Then over here, we find that one. You see what I'm doing? You can go back. And they've got it back to 12,000 years of cross-reference tree rings, because people are always building with wood. So you'll go into a place, and they'll have these giant, like the Temple of Herod, like one of Herod's palaces. There's this giant beams, and they use the beam to cross-reference the dates. So what they're doing is cross-reference all the dating. So we have, because of cross-reference dating, we have a pretty clear idea of the time frame. We're looking at about 966. You take 480 years, you get 1446, give or take a year, you get 1446 as the time for dating. Remember, when I say subtract, I'm talking about add, because we're BC. So when you go further back, you're adding years. So 966 minus 480 years is 1446. That's the Exodus. That gives we know that from the Bible that Moses is 80. So we go back to 1526 for his birth. We know that the second intermediate period ends about 1550. So his father, adopted father, Moses the first, which we talked about, the fact that everybody has the name Moses in their name around this time period in the Egyptian record. I don't know why nobody cares that everybody's named Moses, but whatever. But that's what's going on. And Moses the first is Moses' adopted dad. And of course, this kid is pulled out of the Nile in a basket, and your name is Moses, and your son is Tutmosis, and what do you name this kid? Moses. Okay? And you don't give him any kind of, maybe you don't give him a special extra name, because he's not going to be the Pharaoh, but he's part of your family, so he's Moses. Absolute perfection in the Bible, but for some reason people like to ignore it. Well, that gives us 1446, and then you go with 430, and you're back into, 1800-ish is the beginning of the second intermediate. You're going back 1840s, 1880-ish. So Joseph is coming into Egypt sometime in that late 1800s-ish BC. Right? And then we don't know exact ages, but what's going to happen is his people are all going to come. Well, that matches the 430. In between there, there's space on both sides. So one of the things that confuses people is it says in the records of Egypt that the second intermediate period that we're dealing with was 250 years long. And that's caused some rabbis and some people to suggest 250 years as a length of their time there. And that's fine, except you're missing both sides of that. So we know, for instance, that we've got at least, so let's say that Ahmosis I is the one who ends the second intermediate period by throwing out the Hyksos, right? So now we'll talk about that in a minute. But we've added at least 20 years, 30 years to that for Moses' birth. Then we've added 80 years to that, right? Now we're at 350 already. So we're going to go back with Joseph before the intermediate period starts because we know that he's holding it together. So what's an intermediate period? Egypt falls apart. What are we reading about in the Bible right now? Egypt's being held together. How's it being held together? Joseph's hearing from God. He's setting up the 7 years and 7 years. What's going to happen when he dies? What's going to happen when the Pharaohs turn their back on the Hebrews? It's going to fall apart. And that's going to give us the second intermediate period. So some period of time prior to that, so in the 1800s, so the 19th century BC, in that time frame, Joseph's going to arrive. He's going to become part of the leadership. He's going to become second in command. He's going to get his father to come. And we're going to end up with a total of about 430 years, just like the Bible says. It's you know, and even if you go with 400, whatever you want to do, however you want to do the math, it's basically perfect. For me, it's God's perfect timeline. Just think about this for a second. If I was an Egyptologist, and I was telling you that there was a space of an intermediate period, and then it ends with, so this is so crazy to me, because in the Egyptology record, there's an intermediate period that basically matches the period between Genesis and Exodus. It's like God says, okay, here's Genesis, here's Exodus, and in Egypt, there's like a giant space there too. Like, we don't need a real serious Pharaoh for a while. We're going to need Moses to have a dad. When we got this guy that was with Joseph, in between there, it can do whatever, and that's exactly what happens. Whatever. It's intermediate. That's so crazy to me that that's so perfect. Because the Egyptians aren't doing things based on God. The Egyptians are doing whatever they do, building pyramids and stuff, right? But you see that we tracked after the Exodus, we track everything all the way to David, and we can see what the pharaohs were doing after that and how that all made sense. And that doesn't make sense to most scholars either, because in essence, Moses escapes Egypt into more Egypt. But we talked about how that works. And Amenhotep II looking everywhere for him, but can't find him. Why? Because he's in the middle of a desert. 100,000, 200,000, however many people can't be in a desert. There's nothing to eat, there's nothing to drink unless God is feeding you, right? So this is, it's so perfect. I don't know what else to say. So that's what we're doing right now. We're dealing with this entire concept of the people coming and being there. And right now, the last sort of place we stopped was Joseph. He was testing his brothers, remember? And then they brought back Benjamin. And then he finally told him who he was, and he wept, and everything was awesome. And then he said, you got to bring back everybody. So he sent them with all kinds of stuff and sent them to bring back everybody. And so we pick up in Genesis 46, where Jacob's going to pack up and move the whole family to Egypt. And let's take a look. And I'm in, like I said, the New King James. Any good translation will work. So Israel took his journey with all that he had. It's specific that that word's being used there. God's changed his name. Now, God calls him Jacob still because they're homeboys. But the thing is that Israel needs to be named right there because these are the Israelites. Okay, this is what that means. So Israel took his journey with all that he had. Now, we know he has a lot. And we know multiple generations have been building steam in Canaan. Okay. He came to Beersheba. He offered sacrifices to the God of his father Isaac. And when he did that, in Beersheba, which is an important location, right? God says to him, in the visions of the night. And I love the way that's phrased because it indicates that he has visions a lot in the night. In the visions of the night, God spoke to him. And he said, here I am. So he said, I am God, the God of your father. Do not fear to go down to Egypt, for I will make of you a great nation there. I will go down with you to Egypt. And I will also surely bring you up again. And Joseph will put his hand on your eyes. So God is, I mean, if you think about it, Jacob's probably worried, right? Right now, he's heard that his son's in charge. He's heard that everything is going well in Egypt. But he's about to bring everything. This is kind of betting your entire life on a proposition. You know, all your savings, houses, cars, everything. You're betting it on this idea that looks like it's probably a good deal. But, you know, you don't know for sure what's going to happen, you know. So he's worried, and God is going to reassure him. Don't worry. I am God. I am the God of your father. I'm the one you know about. And I'm telling you, it's going to be okay. So Jacob arose from Beersheba, and the sons of Israel carried their father Jacob, their little ones, their wives, in the carts which Pharaoh had sent to carry him. So remember, Joseph had sent back all kinds of, you know, stuff to help move everything. He like sent the moving crew and all the, you know, all the moving vans. So they took their livestock and their goods, which they had acquired in the land of Canaan, and went to Egypt. And this is one sentence, but it's a lot of stuff. It's a very large amount of stuff. His sons and his sons' sons, his daughters and his sons' daughters, and all his descendants he brought with him. So the entire clan, which is going to be 12 kids, you know, plus 13, but a couple of them don't have kids. They have kids, you know, Joseph has kids in Egypt. But you're talking about very large quantities of kids, very large quantities of grandkids, very large quantities of servants, very large quantities of animals. I mean, this is like an entire nation moving, basically. Now, they're going to name folks, and this is important because they're going to give you, there's two reasons for doing this, and one of them is to set up the way in which things are described, and another way, another reason is to give you an idea of the scale. So, to do that quickly, these were the names of the children of Israel. Jacob and his sons who went to Egypt. Reuben, who was Jacob's firstborn. The sons of Reuben were Hanok, Palu, Hezron, and Carmi. The sons of Simeon were Jamul, Jamin, Ohad, Jachin, Zohar, Shaul, the son of a Canaanite woman. The sons of Levi were Gershon, Kohath, Merari. The son of Judah were Onan, Shelah, Perez, Zerah, but and Onan died in the land of Canaan. The sons of Perez were Hezron and Hamul, and the sons of Issachar were Tola, Puva, Job, Shimron. Sons of Zebulun were Sarad, Elon, and Jaleel. These were the sons of Leah, whom she bore to Jacob in Paddan Aram with his daughter Dinah. All the persons and sons and his daughters were 33. The sons of Gad were Ziphion, Haggai, Shuni, Esbon, Aridi, and Areli. And sons of Asher were Jemnah, Ishua, Ishwe, Berai, Sarah, their sister. Sons of Berai were Haber and Malachel. These were the sons of Zilphath, who Laban gave to Leah his daughter, and she bore to Jacob 16 persons. And the sons of Rachel, Jacob's wife, were Joseph and Benjamin, and to Joseph in the land of Egypt were born Manasseh and Ephraim. whom Asenath, the daughter of Potiphar, the priest of On, bore to him. The sons of Benjamin were Bela, Becher, Eshbel, Gera, Naaman, Eha, Rosh, Muffim, Huffim, and Ard. Muffim, Huffim, and Ard. That's good. And then that'd be like a cool show. That's a legal team. Muffim, Huffim, and Ard. These were the sons of Rachel who were born to Jacob. 14 persons in all. The son of Dan was Hushim. The sons of Naphtali were Jezreel, Juni, Jezer, Shelem. These were the sons of Bilhah, born to Laban. And Rachel, his daughter, born to Jacob. 7 persons in all. All the persons who went with Jacob who came from the body, from his body, besides Jacob's sons' wives, were 66 persons in all. And the sons of Joseph were born to him in Egypt were 2 persons. And all the persons of the house of Jacob went to Egypt were 70. So, the reason that I mention this is because we know that it's not only 70 people, right? We know that because it says these are the people that came from his body, right? So, more than likely, a great deal of these sons and grandsons are already married. Some of them may already have sons because he says his sons and his sons' sons, right? We don't know all those ages, but just give me an estimate on how old the oldest son is about now, Andy. Reuben's approximately how old?
Well, let me think here.
He's the keepers of the scrolls of the dates.
I've got Joseph being born in 1915.
Okay.
So he's got to be at least 14, 15 years older.
Right. And we are 15. So we're probably, so 40 or 50 minimum. If we're at 1800, then we could be as much as 150, but we're probably in the mid-1800s. So we're probably, because we need 40. So we need 1446 plus, well, if we have him living there before they get there, 400 gives us 1846. So our target date for when they're all there is about 1846, give or take a few years. That would put them in the 50-60 range, right? So the point is that they could have kids that are 20-30, that they could also have kids. And there could be wives. And you don't see the wives listed of the kids, but you know they have wives. So this is a thing that happens in the Bible. The most important story for us that demonstrates this is the feeding of the 5,000. Which, as anybody who's done basic Bible study knows, wasn't 5,000. It was 5,000 men that were there. That was like the official meeting. And then there were all the women and children, too. Because some of them hadn't come, and some of them had, and some of them at home, and some were there. And who knows, 10,000 people, maybe more, right? And the reason we know that is because we get given the Gospels as a puzzle. And there's 3 Gospels that are considered to be cross-referencing. And then John is sort of considered to be the key to Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And they have different goals, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Matthew is trying to explain the point of all this to the Jews. And then Luke is trying to fill in all the blanks and explain to everybody in the world, and most importantly, Gentiles. He wants to make sure the Gentiles get the message. And then Mark is just in love with Jesus. He's a kid that was there with Jesus at Jesus' feet, and he's also telling the story of Peter. Pastor Ty likes to call Mark basically the Gospel of Peter, right? So Mark is working with Peter and Paul, and he was there as a child. So he just tells all these miracle stories and how much he loves Jesus. He doesn't get into all these details like lineages and genealogies and the birth story. Our birth stories that we're about to celebrate come in Matthew and Luke. Mark doesn't cover it. John doesn't cover it. They've got different goals. John's goal is the most important, basically. They're all important, but John is the spiritual. He wants to get you to... They'll tell you the story about the bread and the fishes. He wants you to understand it's the bread of life. You know. So John is the one that's dropping the, like, this is God's spiritual hammer into the whole deal. Matthew is telling the story and all the lineages based upon the Jewish kind of idea of this being the Messiah. So they've all got different, slight different views. They're all telling the same story about the Son of God coming to earth and what he did. And then how he died and came back. And all, they're all telling the same story, but they have a slightly different twist on it. So you take it and you put it together, and one of the guys will mention 5,000. Then another person that's from a slightly different culture will say it was 5,000 just men. So there were also a lot of women and children there, right? And that's because their viewpoint. So it becomes this really cool puzzle to figure out. Like, you have to take the story of the same thing told three different ways. You put it together and you get the full picture. Like the last days of Jesus, what exactly happens. You can't get it from one. You can get the idea from one. But you get all of the whole details putting it all together. You know, they mention the Last Supper, but then John tells in detail what happened to the Last Supper. So everybody's filling in each other's blanks. So the reason I mention that is because this happens over and over again. And this is one of those question marks that we brought up back at the Ark. Because the way that things are described, you get a description of the people on the Ark. And you have to make it an intelligent, rational decision, what you think. Because you can think that it's just the people that were described that were on the Ark. That's fine. God can make anything happen. But if you've got a really big intellectual problem with that, and you think, well, that's not how genetics works, and this and that, well, it doesn't have to be only those people. Just like it's not only these people here, just like it's not only those people, those 5,000 people at that place. So the way things are described are based on a need-to-know basis. So what we've done is we've figured out that the Bible can't tell every detail of every story and every single person that's everywhere. It'd be 100 million pages long and none of us could ever read it. We've got to get the important details, like what was this son's name and why do we need to know that? Because that son's about to make this country happen or whatever. So it's these important details that we're getting. And what this list is about those details, but also about the scale. Because if you've got 70 people that are directly related to physical body of Jacob, right? And that's multiplied by wives, kids, servants. It's going to be a lot of people. And that's going to be the people that are going to come and settle. We have no idea what that number looks like, okay? But we know that the important people in that, the people directly related to Joseph and Jacob that are coming into Israel, are 70, okay? And so this is the kind of thing that we have that gives us discussion. Okay? And it says, besides, see, it says this in 46:26. All the persons who went with Jacob to Egypt who came from his body, besides Jacob's sons' wives, were 66 persons. And the sons of Joseph born to him and were 2 persons, and that makes 70. Besides the wives and the servants and the kids and all that. So there could be 1,000 people or more coming in. And that's why we end up with such a large population, and that's why we end up with being the driving force of, the workforce of Egypt. If it was just a few people, it wouldn't matter too much. But it's not a few people. And that means that we have to figure out some other questions. So we've got a pattern of descriptions that we're getting. We've got this mass migration, so it's not a little family. It's a mass migration. The reason that this word hyksos with this big question mark is on the board is there is a question that I don't have an answer to, that no one has an answer to, that's really big and really fun when it comes to the cross-referencing of Egyptology, history, science, and the Bible. The Bible doesn't say anything about hyksos, okay? Hyksos is the term for a group of people that ruled Egypt during the second intermediate period whose origins were in Canaan. They ruled in the north area from the area of Goshen. I do not understand what is going on, but something is going on. Because there is a mass migration of people from Canaan happening right now with Jacob and his entire extended family and all their people coming. They're coming into the north area the area of Goshen, okay, where they're going to settle. Jacob is bringing everyone he ever met, okay? And Joseph is in charge. Now, we're going to end Genesis, and we're going to pick up with a baby in a reed basket, okay? So we don't have biblical information to explain the interim, okay? But something weird is going on if there's an archaeological set of books and evidence about a group of Canaanites taking over from the north during the intermediate period. I have no idea what's going on. But imagine this. Joseph is second in command. We're assuming that he's there for the last pharaoh or two of the period before the intermediate period. These are the pharaohs that know him. Later on it says there's pharaohs that don't know him. Okay, and that causes problems. Okay. We don't know the details of who Pharaoh is. We don't get names. We get Pharaoh. We don't get names. So we don't know the details of that. And Pharaoh is a title, which means when it says Pharaoh told him to do this, and then Pharaoh told him to do that, it could be two different guys. That's why there's so much confusion when Charlton Heston goes and plays Moses, because it says Pharaoh did this and Pharaoh did that, and that could be multiple people. And it was multiple people. But it sounds like the same person, but it's not, right? So we don't know exactly who these pharaohs were and what the deal was. But we know that it dissolves into an intermediate period, which means there's no official pharaoh officially in charge of Egypt. That's what that means. And there's a bunch of different pharaohs and a bunch of different battling. I don't know. You know, a couple ideas would be these guys settled in, became part of the population, and then later on it was recognized that they were from a foreign place, and so the pharaohs began to use them as slave labor. Another possibility would be the pharaoh dies, Joseph's in charge. What happened if the pharaoh died and Joseph was still alive? He's second in command. Would he not be in command? Right? If we had a time of chaos from all this stuff, if you were Egypt, you were like the ruling council of Egypt, and the guy who saved the country, who's been given charge of the country by Pharaoh, and then Pharaoh dies, would you want to throw that guy out or kill him? Or keep him around in case there's another great drought, because he saved the country? Do you understand? I don't know. And what about their kids? Did Joseph's sons maintain power within Egypt? Let's say the Pharaoh had another kid and had a Pharaoh. Another Pharaoh comes after. Does Joseph's son get to be the position Joseph's in for the next guy? Sooner or later, and probably sooner rather than later, they're going to be in slavery at some point, or it's going to be a land which is not their friend. But that could be the strangers in a strange land thing that we read about. But that could be them fighting it out. What if there are several thousand people, and we already know that his grandfather took an army of like servants and went and killed four kings to get Lot back, right? We know Abraham went and got Lot back and killed four kings and got Lot back. If that was the power then, and it's been ramping up since then, what kind of army is Jacob have? Maybe he gave up. Maybe Isaac said, I don't want to do it like that. We're just going to be farmers, whatever. But maybe Isaac learned from Abraham, we got to have an army to protect ourselves. Because remember, everywhere they move, no one messes with them. They could not mess with them because of the power of God. That's completely acceptable. They also could not mess with them because of the power of God and 1,000 armed soldiers. Right? Because we know that Abraham chased the guys down and killed them. All it says is he grabbed a couple household servants, went and killed a bunch of kings and armies, and took his cousin back or his nephew back. Right? I mean, that's crazy. So maybe Jacob is the grandson now. Maybe Jacob has fulfilled the same mission. Maybe he gets it. Maybe they have an army. Maybe they roll in here with all the guys and all their wives and all their kids and all their servants and an army. I don't know. I know one thing. Everywhere they've moved so far, no one messes with them. They give them the land. They back away from them, right? If they go into Goshen, everybody, do the Egyptians back off and go, you guys, take this region. That's cool. Is that what the historians are seeing when they see a group of Canaanites taking over? Are they not seeing a war where the Canaanites come in as an army and take over? They're seeing the Egyptians back off and give Joseph and his people that section. There's not enough evidence in the historical record to prove any of the points that I'm making right now. We don't know. In the Bible, there's a space. In the record, there's a space. But we know that there's a thing called the Hyksos. And many scholars believe that that is Joseph, that the Hyksos coming into Egypt, a large invasion, you know, peaceful or not, a large invasion by a giant force of Canaanites comes in and takes over part of Egypt. And to a lot of scholars, that sounds like what was happening right now. Joseph's in charge. He says, hey, Pharaoh, can I bring my people? He says, sure. And he brings thousands of people, and they settle in Goshen, and that's it. Everybody backs away. That's the Israelite territory, and that's what the archaeology demonstrates. So everybody figured they took it by force from Egypt. Maybe they didn't. So anyway, those are fun things to think about, because right now, as far as I can tell, with every bit of power that I've got and knowledge that I can and research that I can do, with every bit of me, I see an absolutely perfect timeline that God has arranged to the letter, and it matches, and it's about to keep matching, and when it hits Moses, it keeps matching. And everybody's named Moses. And then when they leave, it keeps matching. And then Amenhotep tries to find him and can't. And goes up and down through the entire, corridor of where all the green, lush stuff and the water is, looking for the guys that have to be there. And they're not there. And then after him, multiple people in a row that don't care. When Joshua invades and the walls of Jericho fall down, nobody in Egypt cares. Because by then, the leader of Egypt has married a Mitanni queen, and that's a neutral zone, and they don't care. And then we see letters in the Amarna letters, which were saved by all those guys. That, you know, we see, you know, especially Akhenaten, we see all these letters coming from those guys going, hey, can you help us? We're getting invaded, and they just get ignored because no one cares. And the guy after Amenhotep doesn't care, and then Tutmosis IV, and then he doesn't care because he's got a Mitanni wife, and then his son is called the Magnificent King. He's too busy building monuments, and then his son tries to make it monotheism a thing. So we got like hundreds of years of just, we don't care about that Canaan area at all, and that's when the Israelites do their thing. Later on, we care. And now the Ramses guys are in charge, but that is a country. And they mention the country of Israel by name in Egyptian records starting around 1200-ish to be in the time, in the time specifically of the judges, Deborah, give or take. You know, and we go through the judges and then they establish a kingdom. Briefly, very brief-lived kingdom because, you know, people can't listen to God. But, you know, this, it all makes absolute sense. So,
David's about 1,000, right?
Yeah. He's right about 1,000. Saul's right before him, and then, of course, Solomon's right after him. So we're dealing with 966, would be the fourth year of Solomon. So 970 is about Solomon. 1,000-ish is about David. So there's records of a country or a group of people called the Israelites all the way back to 1200. So it all makes sense. So anyway, they're going to settle. He sent Judah before him to Joseph to point out the way to Goshen. They came to the land of Goshen. So Joseph made ready his chariot and went to Goshen to meet his father. Now Joseph's going to go out to meet him in his chariot. First of all, that's going to be a pretty pimped out chariot, by the way. It's going to be one of those gold kind of chariots. He's going to be looking good, okay? But he goes out to meet him. Why does his father not come to him, right? And I have two reasons for that. First of all, he's so excited, he rushes out there in his chariot. He's got better, faster wheels than everybody. It's like he has a Ferrari. Everybody else is rocking an old Ford. So, you know, he's going to get there first. So he's going to rush out there and fall on his neck and weep for a good while, a long time, it says in the Bible. It's how long he weeps on his father's neck. But another reason I would propose what we're talking about. It's so many people. It's such a large migration that they have to all settle in. They're going to have to find homes, build homes, come up with wells, reopen wells. What do you do when thousands of people move into this town? You have to redo the town. So there's a whole massive immigration, and they're building this place out. They're taking it over, perhaps. I mean, this could be why people think it's an invasion. Maybe they move in and the Egyptians who have the houses there are like, we're going to get out of the way because these are the people of Joseph who saved us, so we're going to get out of the way. Maybe it's peaceful. Maybe it's not. Maybe they move in and say, get out of the way, you know, and everybody leaves. I don't know. But they do get out of the way and they do move in and they have this big, massive area. That's another reason that Joseph has to go to him, because it's all those people are said, and he's not good to travel. Remember, he's being carried anyway. He's not good to travel very much. Israel says to Joseph, now let me die, since I've seen your face, because you are still alive. He is just absolutely overwhelmed, because he's been thinking his kid was dead for years and years and years. His firstborn, you know, from his love of his life, and he just can't believe it. Joseph said to his brothers and to his father's household, I will go up and tell Pharaoh and say to him, my brothers and those of my father's house who were in the land of Canaan have come to me. And the men are shepherds, for their occupation has been to feed livestock. And they have brought their flocks, their herds, and all they have. So it shall be when Pharaoh calls you and says, what is your occupation? Then you shall say, your servant's occupation has been with livestock from your youth until even now. Both we and also our fathers, that you may dwell in the land of Goshen. For every shepherd is an abomination to the Egyptians. Now that's fascinating, but that's a cultural reference. So what's happening here, the Egyptians, because, I mean, they got all the fancy stuff. You know, they got the Nile and the gold and all that. They think of themselves as upper class, and they think of people that are out there in the wilderness as shepherds. They get, people bring things to them and give it to them because they're Egypt. They're the most powerful, you know, empire ever. People have been bringing, they've been building giant pyramids. No one's, that's still the largest man may think, the Great Pyramid. That's just nuts, right? 5,000 years later, it's still the biggest, heaviest, most massive thing we've built. Compared to like the Eiffel Tower or the Twin Towers. Yeah, it's that big. It's that many rocks. So it's crazy. Okay, it's just crazy. So